Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Well, everybody, welcome back to the Vox Pop. And we are very lucky today because we have a great guest. I'm Alan Chartok. The month of May is National Pregnancy Awareness Month. We're just days away from May, so joining us today for Medical Monday is Dr. Nicholas Kulbita, an obstetrician, gynecologist at Bellevue Women's Center in Niskayuna, New York. He's a hospitalist, which means he's on call to deliver babies when a patient's own physician is unable or an emergency arises. Dr. Kulbita earned his medical degree from Universidad del Norte in Mexico. He completed an internship at Beth Israel Medical Center in New York, completed a residency at the Children's Hospital of Buffalo. He's certified by the American Board of Obstetrics and Gynecology. Nick Kulbita, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
There are people scratching their heads right now saying, Kulbita, that's an interesting name. I think I know somebody else named Kulbita. Do you by any chance know our old partner and friend, Lydia Kulbita?
So, yes, we have a pretty interesting relationship. We tend to see each other almost on a daily basis. So it's been a very, very good experience.
Well, we love Lydia Kulbita, and you're very lucky to be married to her. She's a wonderful woman.
I agree.
And I understand she's up for an Emmy. Is that right?
She is. Yeah, she is. We're very excited for her.
For work on Channel 10 here in the region.
Exactly.
Okay, the number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. So, Nick, what's new in baby delivering?
Well, we're seeing, this downturn in the economy. We've taken somewhat of a hit. We had a high period back in 2007 of about 4.3 million births throughout in this country, and we actually got down as low as 3.9 million at its lowest over the last going on 8 years now. And now with healthcare being such a significant item pretty much on a daily basis after the passage of the Affordable Care Act, we're seeing more people coming into the healthcare system, and we're seeing coverage for all women who are pregnant.
But are you saying, and maybe I'm hearing you wrong, that more people are having babies because of the healthcare system?
Well, there's greater access to healthcare now for those women who are pregnant or who are contemplating pregnancy. So that's a significant issue. And with the upturn in the economy,
sure,
I think we're now also seeing, a slightly higher birth rate.
Right. So what's the downside in, is there anything new? I mean, for a while we were seeing, a lot of people who, had various ailments which ended up in an operation. Has that changed? Are less people doing that now?
So the biggest things when it comes to prenatal care these days is the ability to check for certain types of diseases that are genetically linked.
Uh-huh. Tay-Sachs or something like that.
Exactly. So we have availability of testing, whereas in the past, the only tests that were available were invasive tests, such as a chorionic villus sampling or amniocentesis, especially for women over the age of 35. So that's something that was the only test that were available. Since then, we've developed serum-based tests, blood tests,
sure,
which can help us to determine if somebody was at greater risk. And then those women would then go on to get additional invasive testing. But now you have genetic-based tests, which basically rely on cell-free DNA circulating in the mom's circulatory system from the pregnancy. And now we can use that testing to determine if somebody's at significantly greater risk for not just the aneuploidy anomalies like Down syndrome, but you can also test for other things too. And that creates a very good thing because it lessens the need for invasive testing. However, it also opens up a Pandora's box as to how much do we want to know and can we do anything about it?
Sure.
That's really the key thing.
Well, if somebody, for example, Nick, ends up, you say you're going to have a baby and you know early enough that it's going to be Downs, does that mean that some people will opt for, abortion as a result of that?
Well, it's one of those things where there is definitely that possibility. In other words, it's really up to the parents, up to the woman to make that decision.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Jim, our persistent number one caller in almost every Medical Monday. Jim, you're on. What's up?
I was wondering if there are any known viruses associated with leiomyoma or leiomyosarcoma.
So at the moment, there are no known viruses that I'm aware of. So leiomyosarcoma or sarcomas in general, they're basically things that are they're tumors of the muscular system. So basically any part of your body that contains muscles, which is a very large portion of your body, including the uterus in a woman, these are all areas which are susceptible to leiomyosarcomas. And the typical types of tumors that we usually see in women are usually going to be fibroid tumors, which are benign tumor lesions of the uterine tissue. These are not cancers. They do have that small potential of becoming a cancer over the course of years, and they could turn into a leiomyosarcoma. But the vast majority of the tumors are benign. So there really isn't anything at the moment in terms of an associated virus. However, this is where the study, as we were referring to earlier, about genes, genomics, epigenetics, where we want to figure out what is a person's genetic makeup, what are they susceptible to, and there are things in our environment which can either express those genes or suppress those genes. And viruses in other circumstances have been shown to potentially have that effect.
Thank you very much, Jim. Appreciate it. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop at WAMC. Here's one from Boston Spa Anonymous. What is your stance on VBAC? Do you do them? What is the latest recommendations on safety? And Nick, I'll be darned if I know what VBAC is.
So VBAC refers to a vaginal birth after cesarean section. Uh-huh. So one of the things they're always concerned about is there's a rising number of cesarean sections in this country, and we're seeing that rate typically at around 31% nationally.
That's huge.
That is a very large number. And we're always looking at strategies to decrease that number. And one of those strategies is specifically to try to offer women who have a good risk profile. In other words, women who have a good opportunity of delivering vaginally after cesarean section. And I'll be honest with you, that's not all women, but what we suspect is that about 60% of women who've had cesarean sections could be candidates for a VBAC. That number could be greater. It all depends on the risk assessment for these women. So a vaginal birth after cesarean section, it is offered. I suspect that right now it's offered in most of the delivery locations here in the capital region, including in our institution at Ellis Medicine. There are definitely precautions that need to be taken in terms of offering it and allowing.
Like women. What? Having a doctor on call, right?
So having a doctor, so the physician who can perform a cesarean section needs to be immediately present, just in case there is a problem. And that problem specifically is the chance that the old uterine scar can come apart, and that's known as a uterine rupture. The risk of something like that is low, but it's a very real risk, and it can lead to significant health issues for both mom and baby. So it's very important that precautions are taken. So we definitely think that it should be offered to women who want to give it a try and want to be considered for it. It is being done in the capital region. And it's very important to make sure that everybody is working for the safest atmosphere for having it done.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We always require civility. We always require that people are thoughtful and that nobody is looking for trouble. Okay, let's go to Rod in Middletown. Rod, you're on.
Hi, I'd like to just ask a question. How many times, and this is a serious question, how many times per month do you perform a birth from these Hasidic Jews that are completely multiplying like crazy?
Okay, we don't want this. Thank you very much. Okay, he's gone. That's what I was afraid of. 1-800-348-2551. That's just what we need today. You know, there's always somebody who just... just really is beyond the pole. 1-800-348-2551, and we'll take a break and we'll be right back. ¶¶
support comes from Ellis Medicine, providing comprehensive cardiac, neurology, oncology, and emergency care services. Reinventing healthcare one patient at a time, ellismedicine.org. Forum Pharmaceuticals, evaluating the safety and effectiveness of the investigational medication for Alzheimer's disease, 518-264-1130. The C.H. Evans Brewing Company at the Albany Pump Station, a downtown Albany brew pub offering handcrafted beer, lunch, and dinner menus, private parties, and parking, evansale.com. Hancock Shaker Village, Pittsfield, Massachusetts, featuring baby animals on the Shaker Farm, with newborn lambs, piglets, chicks, and ducks on a traditional farm, hancockshakervillage.org. And from Woodstock Day School, an accredited independent school dedicated to providing academic, socially, and environmentally mindful education from nursery school through grade 12. No such thing as an average student. WoodstockDayschool.org.
And Zach's got us right back here where we should be. We've got a Gary in Albany. Gary, you're on. Welcome.
Hi.
Welcome.
Hi, how you doing? Me and my wife, we are expecting a child in about August is the expected due date. And after our second sonogram, the doctor called us back. We're going back for another appointment because he had the images showed or might not have showed. I just want to be sure a possibly insufficient umbilical cord. I think the word insertion was used. I know there was a term for it, but it just escaped me. But in short, basically, worst case scenario, I guess that the umbilical cord is insufficient and might be not supplying enough nutrients to the fetus later term in the pregnancy. If that is the case, I'm just curious what my concerns should be or, if that is the case.
First off, Gary, let me congratulate you and your wife on your pregnancy. I think that's fantastic, and I wish you all the best with it.
Thank you.
You know, it's definitely these ultrasounds now are some of the ultrasounds in pregnancy are a fantastic thing. They give us the ability of seeing things that we've never been able to see before. And at the same time, it's also very important to know that not everything that's seen is a potential problem. There are a lot of questions that come up because literally ultrasound is a gray-based technology. It's neither black or white. It's usually somewhere in between in most cases. So, you know, this is where it's important to follow the recommendations of your physician. Until we have more information, especially with those follow-up visits, follow-up ultrasounds, it's hard to say if there truly is a problem. The term umbilical cord insufficiency can mean many different things in terms of the structure of the cord. It could be just two vessels as opposed to the normal three vessels that we see. It could be how the cord is inserted within the placenta and where it's inserted. And all these things can have an effect because that cord literally is what provides the lifeblood, the life oxygen, and nutrition to the baby. So, and that all comes from the mom. And anything that could potentially impede the circulation of those different things can have an effect on the pregnancy and your baby. So it's important to make sure that the follow-up is done and to figure out how much of an issue it may potentially be. And there is that possibility in some cases that some folks may need to modify their pregnancies specifically based on that feedback from your physician and what they find on those follow-up tests. Clearly, if the baby is growing well, there are no other signs of any compromise, then for all intents and purposes, depending on what the actual problem is or isn't, you should be able to go on to have a full-term pregnancy. But that's why that follow-up and listening to the advice and recommendations of your physician are really critical.
Yeah, so far, you know, the growth and the heart rate and everything is A-OK. They said there might be, as far as the positioning and the size of the umbilical is their concern. So I guess we're going to find out tomorrow morning.
So it sounds at the moment like things are looking good, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Gary.
Right,
appreciate your
care.
Call. All right. 1-800-348-2551. Steve and Lee, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So, I'm particularly interested in the BRCA 1 and 2 genetic mutations, specifically as they apply to ovarian cancer. I have a two-part question. The first part is, if a woman knows that she has the genetic mutation or strongly suspects that she might have the genetic mutation based on family history, is there a way to pre-screen for the early stages of, I guess it's actually fallopian tube cancer that turns into ovarian cancer. And if the answer to that is yes, how long has this been available for?
So, Steve, let me just say that this is a very hot topic these days. We've always struggled with what is the best way to screen for certain types of cancers. Breast cancer and ovarian cancer are definitely two of those types of cancers that we've struggled with. And the recommendations change based on new information, new evidence that comes to play. BRCA1 and 2 gene testing has really, you know, played a major role in changing some of those recommendations. And what we're seeing is that clearly that women who possess those genetic mutations, especially if they possess both of them, then they're at much greater risk for both breast and ovarian cancer. So taking a, you know, providing your physician with a good family history to figure out if you're a good candidate for that type of screening, genetic screening, is very, very important. So having good rapport with your doctor, critical. The more we know about your family these days, the more we're going to know whether you're at risk for certain types of diseases. In terms of ovarian cancer, unfortunately, at the moment, there is no good screening test for it. However, if we do know that somebody possesses both genes or BRCA2, then taking a very close look at their possibility or likelihood of developing ovarian cancer is very important. And as we mentioned earlier, you know, you may potentially have certain gene mutations that we identify by current testing, but it does not tell us when or if a particular individual with the positive test would develop cancer. That's very important to keep in mind, because the presence of these gene mutations have basically encouraged some women to go on to do some very invasive treatments.
Angelina Jolie being one of them.
Exactly. So she's probably the one at the top of the list because of all the coverage of her particular case. But a lot of women are being basically put in the same situation and they're asking themselves that question of whether they should take those steps and to do preventive surgery, you know, in terms of removing the fallopian tubes, removing the ovaries, or completely removing everything, because they're extremely fearful of the possibility of developing cancer. So this is one of the benefits of the testing, is that it gives us this new information. However, what is the best way to proceed once you have that information really has to be individualized to the patient. So having that discussion with your physician about the risks in the family, about, you know, other family members, is critical to making the right choices.
I guess what I'm asking, doctor, and thanks for that response, but I guess what I'm asking is, if you know that you have the genetic mutation, all right, so CA125 is obviously something that's associated with ovarian cancer.
It is, but it should not be used as a screening test.
That's okay. That's what I was wondering. Could like a quarterly test of that provide an early detection method?
So this is where, if somebody does have the genetic mutations, if they possess those genetic mutations based on testing, then what happened in their family is critical. In other words, that other family members develop these cancers. The combination of that information, then, it would be essential for the physician that the woman is working with to then develop a strategy for follow-up for them. And it could potentially be checking CA125 levels, could be checking ultrasounds. It could be just an awareness that if any of certain type of symptoms come up, to make sure they follow up with their physician. So it's very important that yes, if those genes are identified, then you need to work with your physician to develop that strategy that will be right for you. Because again, not all strategies are going to be the same for every woman. It's going to be based on what her desires are, what her fears are, and what her concerns are.
Hey, Steve, we've got to let you go. You got a full line behind you. I appreciate it so much.
Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, you're
bye-bye.
Welcome.
Okay, so I wanted to ask you something. Ovarian cancer is, of course, a very bad killer, yeah, and we're all scared of it. If you caught ovarian cancer, if somebody did develop the right kind of test earlier, would there be fewer deaths from ovarian?
Well, that's the hope. I mean, when it comes to anything that we do in terms of early screening, just like mammograms, yeah, for breast cancer, the hope is that you're going to actually decrease the potential possibility somebody could die from the disease.
Okay. So let's go to Sarah in Massachusetts. All right, Sarah, you're on.
Hi. I had a question about HPV.
Sure.
So I was diagnosed with HPV right after my husband left, and my gynecologist was very much into saying, like, you know, don't go there. It could be, it might not be, whatever, which is fine. But my pap smears have returned to normal, but I'm still testing positive for HPV, and I'm wondering how that's possible.
So HPV, just so that everybody's aware, HPV is a common viral sexually transmitted infection. It's it's really the main implicating factor in the development of cervical cancer. You know, once we started doing pap smears back in the late 40s, early 50s, and there was a trend towards making sure that every woman had a pap smear every year, we've seen a significant reduction in the number of deaths from cervical cancer. At one point, it was the number one gynecologic cancer. There's been a tremendous shift over the last 50 or 60 years. Since then, what we know is that HPV is what basically leads to the development of cervical cancer. So infection with HPV has the potential of causing a cervical cancer. That potential is different in all women based on their ability to fight off the infection, so their immune system. So for some women, they can literally clear the virus, the active presence of the virus out of their system after a certain number of months or years.
What do you mean clear? It just automatically disappears.
So it's still, so in other words, they were infected. And the damage potentially may have been done, but there's no longer an active trace of the virus in their
Is that true for men also?
So yes, and that's the reason why we recommend now that all
everybody takes the
that HPV vaccine exactly
right.
that all men
yeah.
and
well, but you have to be 26 and younger, which is
so typically
I'm out of that range.
Right. So basically, the most important thing for somebody who say was diagnosed with a new case, and it's possible, there are many different strains of HPV, and that's the important thing to keep in mind. We usually test for the high risk strains, so specialized testing would have to be done to figure out exactly which strain somebody has. But it is possible for somebody to get infected with a new strain at a different time in their lives, and that's the reason why somebody's pap smear can all of a sudden change from being normal and goes on to being abnormal. So we're at a point right now where HPV testing is playing a significant role in terms of how frequently a woman should require a pap smear. But yes, changes in your circumstances can lead to potential new infections, which could then show up as positive on the HPV test, which may have been negative at one point, but now all of a sudden is positive. And that's the reason why that follow-up is critical, to make sure that there are no abnormal changes on your cervical cytology.
Now, Nick, one second, please, Sarah. I had read or talked to a doctor who was here once who said that the HPV thing can be almost universal. People who have had sexual intercourse the population is huge.
So it is the most common sexually transmitted infection in across the board, bar none. The likelihood of being exposed is extremely high. And that's the reason why cervical cancer was always a huge problem in the past.
Sure.
So that's why with the new strategies, checking for the active presence of this virus is important. If somebody tests negative, then they can just do routine follow-ups. If they test positive, it's really important to talk to your doctor about making sure that you're getting the type of screening that you need then.
So what do you do about the cervix if it's potentially cancerous?
So there are different types of additional tests that can be done. However, typically when we find cells that are precancerous, we would recommend biopsying that area or removing that area that's affected with those changes so that they do not become more widespread.
Okay. Sarah, really quickly, is there anything else?
Well, yes, if I could get a word in.
Okay, Sarah, yes. then we'll have to, okay, if you're going to be snotty about it, we just don't want it, but go ahead.
I'm not being snotty.
Well, if I can get a word in, yeah. You got your call in, but go ahead and ask your question.
I just don't understand how my pap smears are coming back normal, but I'm still testing positive. That was the gist of my question.
So you can have that's the other thing. Since the virus can be present, when the virus is clearly detected by these tests, that's the time that we're most concerned that somebody's pap smear could change. In other words, the cells could change. And the fact that your tests are coming back, your pap smears are coming back positive is great. That's fantastic. And we want to make sure they continue to come back positive. So that's
normal, you mean, right?
Sorry. So yes, normal. So the fact they're coming back normal is very, very good. And we want to make sure they continue to stay like that. So that's why the additional follow-up, both for your HPV testing and for your cervical cytology, the pap smear testing, is critical. And your doctor may at some point... may also want to consider taking a closer look at your cervix if that's the case. If your HPV test continues to stay positive, then he may want to take a closer look with something called a colposcopy.
And that, yes, I've had that joy.
There you go. So that's why follow-up from here on in is going to be the critical
and
thing.
And Nick, what is a colposcopy?
Colposcopy is where we actually look at the cervix under a microscope through direct visualization by your physician.
Okay. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Right. Let's go to Celeste in Kingston. Okay, Celeste, you're on.
Hi, doctor. Thank you for taking my call.
Hi, Celeste.
Hi. I had a question concerning, I had a cesarean section when I gave birth about a year ago. And since then, I've had other complications. I've had ovarian cysts. I had to have an operation to have that removed. I had twisting of the fallopian tube because of the cyst, and I've recently been herniating through the smaller incisions, not where I had the cesarean section, but they did when they did the removal of the cyst. So my question is, how soon would it be, in your opinion, is it safe to have another pregnancy? And is it possible to do a VBAC following, considering all the different complications?
So, these are all very good questions. When it comes to hernias in general, unfortunately, anytime a woman becomes pregnant, and carrying that pregnancy to full term puts a tremendous amount of strain on the connective tissue of the abdominal wall. And that basically is what increases the risk of developing a hernia in certain parts of the abdomen, because parts of the inner lining where your intestines are can herniate out through the muscle tissue, through the strong connective tissue, and end up just below the skin. And these types of conditions can have implications with future pregnancies. In other words, it can potentially make that situation worse. So for all intents and purposes, it's important to follow up on that issue with your physician, whether that specifically has an impact on your ability to do a VBAC. Right now, I don't think that would be the case. But again, check with your physician about that.
Thank you very much for calling.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Phones are loaded. All of a sudden, they got a little quiet. 1-800-348-2551. Okay, here comes the internet. From Anonymous, what are some of the challenges facing gynecologists in treating older women, in other words, baby boomers?
Well, the baby boomer generation, I think we're looking at 10,000 new Medicare members on a daily basis. So it's definitely burgeoning at the seams. The challenges primarily are really going to be in terms of the types of cancers that people are going to be at greatest risk for as they get older. And unfortunately, that's really the biggest issue with anybody getting older. They're at greater risk for health conditions. So when it comes to women's health care, especially for older women, the potential of developing certain types of cancers like uterine cancer, which is a very common cancer of older women, ovarian cancer, also another possibility, other cancers like colon cancer, breast cancer. All of these things, unfortunately, the risk is increased just because of age. So the biggest challenge that we're going to have is making sure that we have the best screening tests, the best ways to follow up on these different tests. And because it's going to affect so many different people, having those tests is critical, because we do not want to put folks through unnecessary invasive procedures if we can avoid it.
Okay, Nick, thank you for that. We're going to be right back. And Janet, you hang in there. You've been very patient. We have one free phone right now. Everything else is going. We'll take a break. We'll be right back.
report comes from Nathan LaTower Hospital, Gloversville, New York, now offering new MRI technology with silent MRI scans and feet-first exams. NLH.org. United Way of Dutchess Orange Region and the Orange County Chamber of Commerce presenting the 17th annual Orange Open Golf Tournament for the serious and not-so-serious golfer on May 28th. UWDOR.org. Hudson Opera House presenting Concert for Children and Adults with Bard Preparatory Division and Young Musicians this Sunday at 3 p.m., followed by an instrument petting zoo with violins, cellos, double bass, and piano, HudsonOperaHouse.org. Fatigan's Nursery, Latham, New York, featuring fruiting trees, berry bushes, annuals, perennials, flowering shrubs, and gardening guidance to the home gardener since 1920, Fatigan's.com. And from the Doan Stewart School, Rensselaer, New York, an early childhood through grade 12 co-educational day school for more than 150 years, announcing admission reception tomorrow at 4 p.m. DoanStewart.org/visit.
And we are back. Thank you, Zachary. Always appreciate your good work here. My question to the doctor we have heard via the internet is, what is his view on crib bumpers?
So I suppose I don't deal with that question on a daily basis, but I suppose I can give you my personal opinion is that, you know, when it comes to bumpers, you know, the idea is to try to protect something. If there's that potential for getting hurt, I don't see a bumper as being a bad thing in any way, shape, or form, but I'm not exactly sure what kind of bumpers you're talking about and how extensive that is.
Sure.
So in general, protection is good. How much really needs to be dependent on what the circumstances are, and that's always a good thing to talk about with a pediatrician.
And that's right, and I was just going to say that the big distinction here is between a pediatrician and an ob-gyn guy like yourself. Let's go to Janet in Kingston. Janet, thanks for your patience. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. It seems to me as though some research-based practices are not always up to date in labor and delivery, such as continuous fetal monitoring in a normal, healthy woman versus intermittent monitoring and immediate cord cutting. Would you say this is true, and if so, might that change in the future?
Well, there are a lot of different recommendations on potential best practices. Immediate cord cutting, it potentially has some advantage under certain circumstances, but not under all circumstances. And delayed cord cutting, same thing, has some potential advantages, especially if a baby is born prematurely, in order to improve the flow of blood to that premature infant once it is born. So there are certain places where there are definitely advantages. But when it comes to who's doing all these things and are they doing it consistently, you know, those are questions to definitely ask your physician when you're, you know, if you're in the process of a pregnancy, what is their usual practice for doing it? So I think cord clamping was one of the questions. What was the other one that you had?
Delay.
Intermittent monitoring versus continuous fetal monitoring in a normal, healthy woman.
In a normal, healthy woman. So under those circumstances, intermittent monitoring in a normal, healthy woman with intact membranes, no rupture of membranes, I don't really see any problem with doing that. In most cases, that is something that can be offered. However, different hospitals have different protocols in terms of what they do allow and what they don't allow, and that's why it's very important to, again, talk to your healthcare provider and find out what the institution that you're planning on having your child in, what are their usual protocols and policies. You know, when it comes to monitoring, I agree that there may be circumstances where you might not need to monitor all the time. But at the same time, you also have to feel comfortable with doing one versus the other. And I think that this is a very good topic to have a discussion with your physician on.
So, Nick, for everybody else who's listening who doesn't quite get it, what is the period we're talking about doing this monitoring?
So when we're talking about fetal monitoring, so what we're basically doing is we're assessing the heart rate of the baby intrapartum before delivery throughout the entire course of labor. And that labor may last a few hours, may last longer. And wanting to know what the status of that fetus is, you know, for much of your healthcare team is very important, and I think it is for most parents also. However, does somebody need to be on the monitor all the time? And I think the critical point was in a low-risk pregnancy. And there, in other words, there are no specific reasons why somebody is being put into labor or induced for their labor. If there are no specific medical indications, no other problems, they're not trying to do a VBAC, then under those circumstances, doing intermittent monitoring, you know, may be a very good option. But because there are implications for monitoring intermittently that we're not going to always be able to assess the baby, it's very important that it's that decision is made between the soon-to-be mom and her health care team.
Nick, with the rise of men in the delivery room, I've always thought it's a good idea for men, if they go to Lamaze classes or other things, to know what's normal. I knew somebody very well who was in the hospital room with a nurse. The doc wasn't there yet, and the heartbeat was humongous, and the guy had been told about all of this and started to make a fuss. The nurse at the place told him not to worry, that the machine was busted. You know, and he raised hell, and up came the doctor, and the kid was born in distress.
Well, and so you raise a good point. I mean, for most of the men in the delivery room that I usually see, if they haven't passed out and they're not on the ground, then it's always good to have a partner who's well versed in some of the basics. And that's why I think having your partner involved in the prenatal classes, going to the hospital for your tour is a very good idea. And also, you know, talking to the hospital staff when you're there in terms of what are the different things that they're interested in or what they're going to be coming in to check you for during your labor, and to just, you know, have a good awareness of what it is that we're doing and why we're doing it for you.
That's great. Okay, let's go to Mary in Monroe. Okay, Mary, by the way, folks, you want to get in now, it's a good time, 1-800-348-2551. Again, 1-800-348-2551. It's a good time to call. Mary, you're on.
Okay, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am currently 36 years old and am pregnant with my third child. I recently had my first trimester screening, and the doctor said everything came out wonderful. I have the chances of a 20-year-old to have a child with a chromosomal birth defect. The genetic counselor did have a concern that I had a low PAP A number, putting me in the fifth percentile, and I'm just wondering, how much do I need to be worried about that number?
So first off, I want to congratulate you on your pregnancy. I think that's great. And I want to wish you all the best for a very good pregnancy and labor and delivery. When it comes to this type of screening, I think we were talking about that a little bit earlier, there are many different ways of screening for certain genetic defects, the most common of which is the aneuploidy that we screen for, Down syndrome. So trisomy 21, trisomy 18, trisomy 13. These are all the important ones that we tend to screen for, and those specifically increase in risk with an increase in age. So all the screening methods that are currently out there that are serum-based or blood test-based, the one that you had, depend on a lot of different proteins that we're checking for. And it's the combination or balance of those proteins that we're looking at to determine what the risk level is for developing any one of those conditions in your baby. There are other tests that are available that may potentially be better screening tests. When it comes to somebody over the age of 35, the most important thing is that none of these tests is 100% accurate. So whether you do DNA testing or whether you do blood testing, none of them are 100% confirmatory. So even though it shows a low risk, there may still be that small possibility that somebody we may miss, or having a false negative test, which basically means that fetus could be affected, you know, with one of these trisomy conditions. So the test that a lot of these blood tests are trying to avoid is the invasive test, which is the amniocentesis. Mm-hmm. And that would be one of the tests that anybody over the age of 35 would need to consider. So you have to feel comfortable with all the information that you got from the serum screening. If you are, then that's a reason not to go on to do more testing that's more conclusive. If you're not comfortable, then really the only test that you really can do under those circumstances would be the the invasive test or the genetic amniocentesis, or if you're early enough in the pregnancy where a chorionic villus sampling is an option, then that too would be an option. But all screening tests have a potential of being incorrect or having a false negative. So that's why it's very important to talk to your doctor. If there is that small potential and you're not comfortable with that potential, everybody's different. Some folks are very, very comfortable with having a low risk for some for a certain type of condition. Others are not. And that's why that decision as to what testing and how comfortable you are in terms of foregoing the more invasive test really has to be done with your physician.
Mary, thank you. Thank you. You got a big line in back of you, and we appreciate your calling. Thanks
again. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to Peggy in Great Barrington. Hiya, Peggy.
Hi. I'm calling about a question regarding causes and treatment of endometriosis.
Peggy, could you make sure that your mouth is close to the telephone sender because we're having trouble here. Go ahead.
I'm calling about endometriosis.
So endometriosis is a relatively common disorder, or at least a relatively common cause for a type of condition known as chronic pelvic pain. And basically, it can potentially lead to a very debilitating form of pelvic discomfort and pain for some women. The reasons or the causes of it at the moment are unclear.
So is it the migrating of tissue? Is that what happens?
Well, so by definition, endometriosis basically means that we find endometrial gland tissue, the tissue that changes on a monthly basis in all women's cycles and leads to bleeding at the end of that cycle, can be located outside of the uterus. And it could attach itself to your colon, to the outside part of your uterus, to your ovaries, to your fallopian tubes, to just about any other part in your body, you know, per se, but in most cases, it's usually located somewhere in the pelvic region. So there is no one specific reason why a woman would develop it. However, we do know that women who have a family history of it are more likely to develop it in other family members. So that is one of the things that has been implicated in it. In terms of what else causes it, unfortunately, we don't know.
So, Peggy, did you have a specific question about endometriosis?
Yes. Regarding treatment options. And other than hormone therapy, can you speak to that?
Sure. So treatment options always have to be individualized to the particular patient based on age, based on where they are in childbearing, whether they're in the process of considering it or that they've completed it, and also whether other, you know, depending on what treatments have worked and have not worked for somebody. So for many women, they're actually do very well with just the use of an as-needed pain medication for their pain. And in most cases, if they're proactive, they can use that medication like an NSAID or over-the-counter ibuprofen, which would typically help with pain. There are other forms of pain medications out there that could also be beneficial. But for the vast majority of women, these work very well. For others, they may need surgical intervention, hormonal treatments. And those hormonal treatments, there are multiple ones out there. And for some, the ultimate treatment may actually be the removal of certain tissues, including the uterus and the endometriotic implants outside of the uterus. So that, I would say, really only affects a small number of women who are suffering from endometriosis, thankfully. But those are all potential treatment options, and they have to be tailored to the individual.
Peggy, we're trying to get everybody in. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it.
Welcome.
Okay, let's go to Jack in Latham. Jack, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My wife and I are trying to start a family soon, and she has some medical issues, including hypothyroidism, and piggybacking sort of off of what Peggy's already asked, something called spotty endometriosis, which has come up in the past. And you know, I'll hang up and let you address.
No, stay on. Let me have a question for you, Jack. Go ahead.
Okay. So I'm just curious how those might affect our ability to conceive and what steps, if any, we might want to take to address any issues that might arise. Thank you.
Sure, you're very welcome, and I wish you all the best of luck with a future pregnancy for you and your wife. The most important thing when it comes to medical conditions, this is why it's important to be seeing your doctor before you become pregnant. It's very important that any chronic condition is managed and managed appropriately before pregnancy takes place, because that helps to lessen the chance for complications during the pregnancy. As far as a thyroid condition, thyroid conditions are very common for many women, and therefore they're very common during pregnancy. However, the take-home message when it comes in general to thyroid conditions is that as long as they're well managed, then the likelihood is that they'll have minimal impact on the pregnancy. So the management, making sure that your thyroid numbers are staying normal, that you're on the right amount of medication, these are all very important factors, and follow-up is clearly essential in that respect. So that kind of management is very important. And the second part of your question, I think, was there was one other part.
Something she had some issues in the past where
with
doctor,
endometriosis.
Yes, and they called it spotty endometriosis. I don't know what the difference is there.
So
if there's anything in particular.
Since endometriosis has always been suspected to be a hormone-based condition, the good news is that technically pregnancy is a cure, at least a temporary cure for endometriosis. Mm. So the hormones that are produced by the pregnancy basically help to let the person's endometriosis be managed or under control. That does not mean that it won't return after the pregnancy is over. But, you know, many women have reported that there were changes in what they experienced in terms of pain from endometriosis after a pregnancy or two.
Jack, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Let's go to Sherry in Malta. Okay, Sherry, you're on.
Hi. Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm 50, and I'm in a perimenopausal stage, and I'm not exactly sure how to ask this question on the radio. When I, my husband and I are active around the time of my menstrual period, and I'm having a period, which I only get periodically, I get pain, and I wondered if that was a hormonal thing. It doesn't seem like anything else is really, you know, going on. It seems to go away after a week or so after my cycle. I don't know if that's
so you can answer. Perimenopause tends to have a lot of potential issues, and typically the most common issue are the presence or absence of hot flashes or vasomotor discomforts. That tends to be the most common, flushing, feeling cold or hot under certain circumstances. Those things are the most common issues. The other most common issues are vaginal dryness and irritation, and that can lead to discomfort, especially with sexual intercourse. And typically, if that's basically what potentially is happening, then the use of vaginal lubricants is probably the best first or initial course of action. However, if the problem does persist, then clearly you want to talk to your physician about it to figure out what other treatments might be available. But the fact that it does go away may or may not have anything to do specifically with perimenopause. It just means that you're still not quite, you're not in menopause yet. And in order for the diagnosis of menopause to be made, you have to basically not have a period for at least a year and be at the right age.
Well, one of the things the doctor did talk about with me was the possibility of giving me some kind of hormone replacement. But I know there's, backlash to that as far as, risks of taking those kinds of things. And I'm kind of trying to hold off on doing something like that as long as I can.
Okay, you've got to get a real fast answer here, Doc.
So yes, hormone replacement therapy is a very effective treatment for perimenopausal and menopausal symptoms. But really, you want to determine what the real problem is, and figure out which hormone treatment is the best, and it should always usually be with a time limit in terms of using it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. I wish you all the best.
Thank you very much. And ladies and gentlemen, I can't believe it, but we are basically out of time. We do have a real fast question, Doc, on IUDs. Are they out of fashion? Or are they in fashion?
Oh, I think IUDs are actually, we're going to see them becoming more in fashion. I think that they're an excellent form of contraception, very effective, very available, and they have a lot of other health benefits, too.
So we are out of time. My apologies to the people who have called up, like Catherine of Woodstock. We're just not going to be able to do it today. And I want to thank Dr. Nicholas Kolbita, an old friend, for joining us today. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Joe Makowitz for answering the phones. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Alan Shartok. Thanks again, everybody, for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at wamc.org/VoxPop. You know, the fund drive begins on the 1st of June. And if you want to sign up, this is a great time to do it. Just go online and follow the prompts. We'd love to have you as a volunteer, and we would love to have you just joining us during that time. Again, thanks, everybody. Stay tuned now for a news update.